Well, welcome everybody. Good morning. This is Bio 241, February 16th. And this is the last lecture before your first lecture exam. So if you have any questions, now's a good time. We got to still finish up chapter 3. We were talking about genetic control last time. We just started to talk about extended and condensed chromatin. So let's just go back really quick and figure out something about protein synthesis. How many steps does it take, okay, to make a protein inside your body? I would say 2, and you got to know the names of those steps and become a little familiar with what that means. What are the 2 steps? Yeah, transcription, that comes first, followed by translation. All right, where does transcription always take place? In the nucleus, where does translation take place? In the cytoplasm, right, the cytoplasm. So, and remember, it's a one-way street. What makes proteins in our body, or what determines the primary structure of a protein, which is what the amino acid sequence is, the primary structure of nucleotides in a nucleic acid like DNA. All right, so what's the language of DNA? Okay, what's the language? What's the basic building block of DNA? Nucleotides. What's the basic building block of RNA? Nucleotides. That's why that first step, when you convert information from DNA to RNA, we call it transcription, because transcription is just a photocopy, right? It's just a duplicate copy of DNA. But it can leave the nucleus, right? What's going to happen to a cell if the DNA gets corrupted or lost? Yeah, it's going to die. But what happens if you take a photocopy of that information and you lose the photocopy of it? Does the cell die? No, it doesn't. It can always go back to the nucleus and make another copy, right? So that's why eukaryotic cells go through that additional step, right, of keeping DNA inside the nucleus. It's nice and protected. All right, and then the second step, translation. Why do we call it translation? Because you're going from what language to the other language? A nucleotide language to amino acid language, right? So we're going to talk about that step in a little bit detail today, just a little bit. All right, so on this slide that I'm showing you right here shows the control of that first step of protein synthesis. What's that first step called once again? Transcription, right? And so we have, there it is. Here we have condensed chromatin, which is a nice, safe form of chromatin. It can't be damaged because it's all the very thin filaments of chromatin or DNA are wrapped up on these nucleosomes right here with these histone proteins, so it's nice and protected, but if it's nice and protected, it can't be used. When this complex becomes acetylated, then it unwinds, it unpackages itself, and so it becomes what we call extended chromatin, and then it can be transcribed as long as there are some transcription factors that bind to the DNA. Then an enzyme called RNA polymerase can also bind, and RNA polymerase will then make an RNA molecule based on complementary base pairing with the DNA molecule. So we call DNA a polymer because it contains repeating subunits over and over and over and over again. So that's a polymer. RNA is a polymer, right, because it has 4 bases that are used over and over and over again to make RNA. And a polymerase is just an enzyme that can make a polymer, so there can be a DNA polymerase. What kind of molecule does DNA polymerase make? What kind of polymer does DNA polymerase make? DNA. It makes DNA. And what kind of enzyme is used to make a polymer RNA? That would be RNA polymerase, right? So that's where that name comes from. All right, so when these regions become deacetylated, then they wind back up, okay, and become condensed chromatin. All right, so RNA synthesis. So one gene, we used to think that one gene codes for a polypeptide chain or one protein inside your body, right? And each gene is several thousand nucleotide pairs long, and the exact sequence of these nucleotides is going to determine the exact sequence of amino acids within a protein. All right, and the enzyme that is used to make RNA is called RNA polymerase because RNA is a polymer. is going to bind to a start sequence in DNA. So there's a special sequence of nucleotides in DNA which signals the start of transcription. And DNA then unzips, because DNA is what kind of molecules? It's single-stranded or double-stranded? It's double-stranded, so not only does it have to be extended chromatin in an extended form, but it has to unzip. Now, is that a really difficult process, to unzip the DNA double helix? I would say no. I see a lot of people shaking your heads no, okay, which is okay for right now. That's an okay answer. It's not my favorite answer typically, but it's all right for right now. Which is, and that's the right answer. Why is unzipping DNA relatively easy to do? Because it only has hydrogen bonds, right? So you can put a DNA double helix together, two complementary strands together, and you can unzip them and then zip them back up and unzip them all day long, because it doesn't take a lot of energy because they're just hydrogen bonds. Okay. There are certain promoter regions that need to have transcription factors bound to them before transcription can take place. So this is just a way of controlling transcription. And so that's important for maintaining homeostasis in these different cells. So here we see, all right, we see a double helix right here. And it's labeled, but pretend you don't see the label. I probably shouldn't have brought it to your attention. But if we look at this part of the illustration, what kind of compound or what kind of molecule is this and why? Let's analyze this compound. Is it RNA or DNA? It's DNA, because it is double-stranded. There's another reason why you could tell this is DNA right away, because I see thymine, right? And thymine, or these T's right here, are only found in DNA, not RNA. So here is a double strand of DNA. And so the RNA polymerase is going to start someplace down over here. There's going to be a start signal, and it's going to unzip the DNA molecule. And then it's going to crawl along this molecule and incorporate, and it's going to build now another single-stranded nucleic acid. And the primary sequence of nucleotides are going to be added based on what? The DNA molecule, which is this right here. So here's the DNA molecule. So the DNA molecule is going to act as a template to build the complementary RNA strand. All right, so what are the base pair rules for making RNA? Well, C in RNA will base pair with guanosine, right, in DNA. And, of course, the reverse will happen. All right, but now in RNA, we don't have thymines. What do we have instead? Uracil. And uracil is going to then base pair with adenine instead of thymine. So if we look over here on the other side of the DNA molecule, I see a nice thymine. So the primary sequence of nucleotides in RNA is just not random. It's going to be determined by this strand of the DNA. We call that the sense strand, because it contains, right, the primary sequence of, or the information necessary to make to determine the primary sequence of amino acids in a protein. All right, this other strand, we're learning more and more. Maybe it's used for some kinds of processes. Every once in a while, we maybe have one or two examples where this antisense strand right here can be used to make a protein, but it's by far usually only one strand that is used. So this is what we call the gene for a particular protein. Okay, so this, what is this process right here? When we use base pairing rules and RNA polymerase to make RNA from a DNA template. That's transcription. Where does that take place? Always inside the nucleus, right? Always inside the nucleus. So that's transcription. The kinds of RNA molecules that are made, okay, we basically have three kinds, right? We have ribosomal RNA. Ribosomal RNA is used to make a ribosome. And don't forget, a ribosome is the workbench where a protein is made. So there has to be amino acids that are brought to the ribosome in order to make a protein. And the molecule that brings amino acids to a ribosome to make a protein are called taxiRNAs. And every book that I've read calls them a transfer RNA. I like to call it a taxi little molecule that brings amino acids to the ribosome to make an amino acid. So either one works for me, right? But tRNA is the little transporter RNA that brings amino acids to the ribosome. All right, but the ribosome by itself doesn't know what amino acid should be incorporated into which position within a protein. All right, and that's the job of messenger RNA. The messenger RNA contains the code for synthesizing a protein. In order to make an amino acid, you need the workbench, which is rRNA. You need amino acids. That's what tRNA's job is, to bring amino acids to the ribosome. But you also need, to know how to spell out the protein in terms of amino acids, and that's the job of messenger RNA. So sometimes we call that the message that determines the primary sequence of amino acids within a protein. Messenger RNA comes from a larger molecule that we call a pre-mRNA or pre-messenger RNA. The pre-messenger RNA can be altered within the nucleus to form a competent or the exact messenger RNA that the cell needs at a particular time. All right, so this pre-mRNA is the precursor to messenger RNA. So the pre-mRNA might be lysed or spliced together in different ways to make a competent messenger RNA. So let's take a look at how that might happen. So here we see a double-stranded molecule, so that's DNA. Don't forget, then it has to unzip. Okay, and then it's going to be transcribed. So here we have the transcript. So sometimes we call this the transcript. And the transcript is what kind of molecule? Is it DNA or RNA? It's going to be RNA. And you can see that it has different segments. It's got some lighter segments and some darker segments right here. The darker segments we're going to call introns, and the lighter segments we're going to call exons. So in this particular transcript, I see three light regions and two dark regions right here. All right, so two introns, and the lighter regions are what we're going to call exons. And the way that, so this is the pre-messenger RNA molecule. It's got to be processed to become the messenger RNA molecule, and look what happens. Right, the introns kind of fold up on each other, and there is an enzyme that clips out this space, and then it joins together these two exons that were separated via this intervening space that we call the intron. Right, so these introns are clipped out of the pre-messenger RNA molecule. These three segments are joined together, and now you have a nice competent messenger RNA molecule that can build the protein that the cell needs. And these introns right here then pretty much are tossed away. But we're beginning to learn some of the functions of these introns, right? But not so important for this class. So interspersed within a gene, so this is a gene from on DNA. Which one is it? So here is the sense strand. So the gene goes all the way from here to over here. That's the gene on DNA. It makes this pre-messenger RNA. And then this pre-messenger RNA can be spliced together in a number of different ways. Okay? Maybe only this first segment is used that will make a protein. Maybe it's only the second segment right here that can make a protein. Or maybe the first exon and the second exon would be spliced together to make a protein. So we see that even though you have one gene, there are a number of proteins that can be made from that one gene depending on how these exons are spliced together, right? So there's many different combinations depending on how many exons there are. So you saw that on one of the previous slides, right, that the genome is just the genes that you have in your body. And now what can you tell me about the proteome? Is the proteome going to be bigger or smaller than the genome? It's going to be bigger because one gene might have the possibility of making four or five different kinds of proteins depending on how it's spliced together. So we invoke alternative splicing to explain why one gene can produce different kinds of proteins depending on the needs of a particular cell. Okay. So the human genome has about 25,000 genes, yet the proteome is over 100,000 different kinds of proteins. So one gene codes for, on average, three different kinds of proteins, and we explain that by invoking what? Alternative splicing of exons, right? And that's a common feature of eukaryotic cells, like what we have in our body, but that is certainly not a characteristic of prokaryotic cells, like bacteria, for instance, right? So for bacteria, we can fall back on our old understanding of genes. In bacteria, every protein has a gene responsible for it. So there is a one-to-one correspondence. But our understanding of that might change as well. Okay. So if your body wants or needs a lot of a particular kind of protein, this kind of structure can develop. And what we see, the little dots right here, are ribosomes. And what's the function of a ribosome, once again? It's the workbench for where a protein is being made. But this ribosome needs to have a messenger RNA to make a protein. If the cell needs a lot of that protein, then there are numerous ribosomes can attach to one messenger RNA, and all these ribosomes will be making the same protein over and over and over again. Right, and they'll just read down the messenger RNA. So sometimes we call this a polysome, and each one of these little strands right here is a newly synthesized protein. Maybe this is a goblet cell, and this is the protein that's being used to make mucus, and maybe the goblet cell is really active, secreting a lot of mucus, for instance. So this is a very busy cell making that particular protein. And we can see that pretty easily on an electron micrograph. All right, so here, I think this is a picture in your book, or maybe I stuck it in the slides, I'm not sure. You can look for table 3.2, but this is probably one of the most amazing slides in your whole textbook or the whole class, all right? Because it is the genetic code, all right? So, and the reason why it's amazing, because it's not just a genetic code. Do we have genetic code anywhere on this slide? No? Okay. But there's another word that describes this right here. It's a partial genetic code. All right, it's the universal genetic code. It tells you that if you have this primary sequence of nucleotides in RNA, like UAG, that's going to be a stop signal, or if you have UUU, all right, what is going to be incorporated into a protein at this location in a messenger RNA is going to be the amino acid phenylalanine. All right, but if you have a different triplet, UCC, then a different amino acid is going to be incorporated into a protein as it's growing. And we say this is the universal genetic code because all life forms use this same code. Maybe there's a few examples or very small changes. All right, so if we look in bacteria, or if we look in mice or humans, right, or worms or anything, if there's a triplet on a messenger RNA that is AAA, what's going to be incorporated into a protein that's growing when it runs into this triplet code AAA? It's going to be a lysine amino acid. So that can be used as evidence of evolution, right? So all life forms use the same genetic code. It's certainly not scientific proof, but certainly it's very nice supporting evidence that evolution has occurred because all organisms use the same universal genetic code. So here we see a sequence of three nucleotides in DNA, and if we were to transcribe TAC, all right, what would be the primary sequence of this triplet in an RNA molecule? What would bind to thymine? Okay, A, and then what would base pair with adenine? In DNA, it would be T, but since it's RNA, it's going to be a uracil, right? And what base pairs with cytosine? Okay, guanine right here. So here is the first triplet that we have in a messenger RNA. And as a matter of fact, on your slide, you might want to jot down mRNA right here to make sure that you know that it's not transfer RNA or ribosomal RNA. And if it is on messenger RNA, just like what we're describing, then we're going to call that a codon. So where do you find codons? They're going to be located on which kind of RNA? The messenger RNA. All right, so that's a little bit redundant. If you say RNA codon, you know that it is messenger RNA, but just jot that down specifically. All right, so this is the codon for stopping. AUG is the codon for starting. That's where transcription starts. All right, so then what would be the protein that is synthesized if this is the messenger RNA that has AUG, UAG, UUU, UCC, UGG, all the way down to GAG would be phenylalanine, serine, cytosine, proline, lysine, right on down the line. So you don't have to memorize this chart, but you should at least know that this is the messenger RNA molecule. All right, so if you determine, so if this messenger RNA determines the primary sequence of this protein that's being made, what is it also determining? Yeah, the secondary structure, tertiary structure, the final structure of this particular protein, which then determines its function inside the cell. All right, so that's why nucleic acids determine how cells function, because they determine the structure of all these different proteins that are inside the cell. Okay, so this is the universal genetic code. So let's go through a couple of processes. On the top right here, I see a double-stranded molecule. So what do you recognize that to be? That's a nice DNA molecule. And does it have thymines or does it have uracils? It's got thymines. Can a molecule have both thymines and uracils? It cannot. It's got one or the other. If it's thymines, then it's DNA. If it's uracil, then it's RNA. All right, now don't forget, before transcription takes place, what has to happen to this double helix? It's got to unzip, right? And here we see an unzipped DNA strand right here, and then I see a complementary strand down below it. Now this complementary strand, can you tell me if it's DNA or RNA? What would you look for? Yeah, we'd look for uracil, and I see some uracils in here. All right, so this is actually one strand of RNA, which is how RNA usually exists. So what's the name of that process that converts, right, the primary sequence of DNA into a primary sequence of RNA? That's transcription. That always happens inside the nucleus. Then this molecule leaves the nucleus, goes into the cytoplasm, joins up with a ribosomal RNA, and then the first three triplets right here, the first three nucleotides are revealed within a ribosome. And what does AUG signify? It's a start signal, but it also will incorporate a methionine amino acid. So I see that here is a sequence of amino acids. These are all different amino acids. You don't have to know their shape, but you should at least recognize what an amino acid kind of looks like, with the alpha carbon and a carboxyl group, amino group, right? So that is all similar in each of these amino acids. These are only different in that R position. Right? Glycine only has a hydrogen atom in that R position. All right, so the first three, since this is messenger RNA, this is codon number one. And then the ribosome is going to move down to this next triplet right here. And what's the next triplet? It's going to be GGC. And if you look at a universal genetic code, that's going to code for glycine to be incorporated into the protein. And what forms right between methionine and glycine right in this location? You actually drew that out in lab, some of you, right? A nice peptide bond forms right here through what, a dehydration synthesis reaction. When that takes place and the ribosome moves down to the next codon, and that's UCC, and you could look that up in your universal genetic code, that's going to correspond to serine. When that transfer RNA brings the serine into the ribosome, then another peptide bond is going to form between glycine and serine, and the ribosome is just going to move down this messenger RNA until it reaches the stop sign. You can look up what the stop sign is. What is a stop sign? It is UAG. That's going to cause termination, okay, of the building of this protein right here, and then you have a nice protein that can go in different places in your body. If it's rough ER, what's the fate of that protein that's made by rough endoplasmic reticulum? It is destined to be trapped inside a vesicle its entire life. That vesicle might be part of the secretory process, so that protein can actually exit the cell. But if it's a free ribosome in the cytosol, then that protein is now going to be trapped inside the cell, not in a vesicle, can't be secreted either. All right? So a protein can have different fates depending on where that ribosome is when it is synthesized. Here is sort of a picture of a transfer RNA, just a two-dimensional view of a transfer RNA. And it knows to bind to the messenger RNA based on base pair rules. So there we can see that it has four kind of loops to it. Okay, a couple of hairpin turns right here and right here. This end of the transfer RNA will bind a particular amino acid. And then on the opposite end of the molecule, we have something that's called the anticodon. All right, so what molecule contains codons? Codons. It's going to be an RNA molecule. What kind of RNA molecule has codons? The messenger RNA. And the transfer RNA then has an anticodon. And guess what? The anticodon will match up very nicely to the codon on a messenger RNA based on what kind of rules? the base pairing rules, right? So if you have a messenger RNA, okay, here's a good question. What has to be the codon on a messenger RNA to match up with UUA on a codon that's located on a transfer RNA? It has to be what? AAU. And if it's AAU on a messenger RNA, or if AAU is the codon, then base pairing will happen very nicely with a transfer RNA that has an anticodon that base pairs with it, which is UUA. Okay, so that's how the transfer RNA knows which amino acid to bring into the growing protein. All right, so remember, messenger RNA contains the codon, and transfer RNA has the anticodon. They match up really nicely. They can bind and unbind very easily. Why is that? Because it's nice, simple hydrogen bonds, right, that bring these molecules together. So here's a little bit better illustration of that process. Here you have the workbench, which is a ribosome, and it contains some proteins, but it contains also a couple different ribosomal RNAs that come together, and I think I showed you a picture that there's a tunnel through this particular complex that the messenger RNA moves through, and you can see that a sequence of three nucleotides makes a codon on this messenger RNA. So again, codons are on messenger RNA. And either the messenger RNA moves through the tunnel or the ribosome moves over the messenger RNA molecule. You could consider it either way. There are two locations within the ribosome. There's one location that has a transfer RNA that is the amino acid that's just coming in, right? So here is the active codon E that's determining what amino acid is being brought into the ribosomal RNA. There's a second site right here that has a transfer RNA that has the growing protein chain on it. Okay, when the taxi RNA brings in a new amino acid, then a nice peptide bond is formed. All right, and when that peptide bond is formed, this growing chain is added to position 5 right here. Then the ribosome moves up one more notch, reveals another codon on the messenger RNA, and this polyprotein chain gets bigger and bigger on each one of these steps until it reaches the stop signal, right? And then this whole thing dissociates, and this protein then is free to end up either inside of a vesicle or freely floating around inside the cytoplasm. All right, but what you should know is, what's the name of this process right here? It's protein synthesis, but a more specific name. What's the most specific name of this process? This is translation. Going from a nucleotide language to what? An amino acid language, and that happens in the cytoplasm. Okay? Not inside the nucleus. So this is translation. All right, we said that depending on where that ribosome is, then the fate of that protein, the polypeptide, will be different. Here's a ribosome that is attached to a membrane, so this has got to be rough endoplasmic reticulum. Oh, that reminds me. I got to stop the discussion about rough endoplasmic reticulum. And that's because I forgot to say something about smooth endoplasmic reticulum. All right, so in your mind, what can you tell me? What's the function of rough ER? Rough endoplasmic reticulum is? Protein synthesis, and if you want to say translation, that's fine with me because translation is a subset or a sub-step of protein synthesis. Now, what about smooth endoplasmic reticulum? I think I forgot to mention something, but it will be important later on in the class. It's for lipid synthesis, right? That's a nice bullet point, but it's also important for something else. Okay, and maybe I didn't mention it, and I got to mention it. It's important for storing calcium ions, right? Because you look at a diagram where you see calcium ions across the cell membrane, and where is calcium at a high concentration when we just think of the plasma membrane of a cell? It's high outside the cell, like sodium, right? It's low inside the cell, and it's low inside the cell in the cytosol in particular, because there's smooth endoplasmic reticulum in some cells that actually pump calcium from the cytosol to the inside of smooth endoplasmic reticulum, right? Which then takes it out of the cytosol. So calcium could be high inside some smooth endoplasmic reticulum, but in the cytosol, it should always be low concentration. But there could be some signals that's going to cause the release of calcium. It might open up channels in smooth endoplasmic reticulum. If there are calcium channels that open in smooth endoplasmic reticulum, what happens to calcium? Will it want to move? Yeah, because the cytosol is negatively charged, right? Plus, there's very little calcium in the cytosol, so calcium is going to rush out of the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, flood the cytosol with calcium, and that can be an important signal under certain circumstances, okay? And then those pumps are going to work, pump calcium out of the cell, pump it back into the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. And when those pumps are working, what happens to cytosolic concentrations of calcium? Then it goes back almost to zero as a result of that. So that calcium can be thought of as like a switch. When calcium is high inside the cell, it activates certain physiologic factors. All right, and when it goes to zero once again, then they become deactivated. All right, so that was a little side trip that I needed to take because we're going to look at that later. Let's get back to rough endoplasmic reticulum. All right, so here's some rough ER. And how do we know this is rough endoplasmic reticulum? Yeah, because we see ribosomes all over the place. Here's a messenger RNA that contains what? Codons, right? Those the triplet codes are codons. And then transfer RNAs are going to bring amino acids that have the anticodons that can base pair right in this region right here, and this is the growing polypeptide chain, and the peptide chain then is inserted into the cisternae, or the space, the interior space of the rough endoplasmic reticulum, and the amino acids in the very beginning of this protein right here have a bunch of hydrophobic kinds of amino acids, so it's very easy for them to pass through the membrane and end up trapped inside the cisternae of this rough ER. And then these proteins then get passed on to the Golgi apparatus where they're modified, and then after modification, they're still trapped inside behind a membrane. They're put into vesicles, and those vesicles can stay inside the cell. What kind of protein might stay inside the cell, inside of a vesicle? And maybe you could think of a specific name of a protein that is trapped inside the cell inside of a vesicle. How about a protein that can digest things? Lysozyme. Yeah, lysozyme is a protein that started off just inside a rough endoplasmic reticulum, ended up inside of a lysosome, and its job is to digest things, right? And peroxidase is another protein that's trapped inside of a peroxisome for detoxifying compounds inside of a cell, as opposed to mucus molecule, okay, which is put in a vesicle, and then it is secreted on the outside of the cell. What kind of cell secretes mucus? A goblet cell. Yeah, that's just some ancient anatomy knowledge there. Okay. So secretory proteins leave the endoplasmic reticulum in vesicles, go to the Golgi where they're modified. Oh, this is just what we're talking about, so I don't want to go over that again. DNA replication is important because cells in your body die, and you have to have a process to replace those cells. All right, and you're familiar with that. That's called mitosis, right? Another reason for mitosis is not to replace old and dying cells or old and dead cells, but at one stage in your life, you were just a single cell. Anybody know what that is? Anybody take a biology class? What's that single cell person that you were at one time has got a name. It's not your name, but the scientific name, which is a zygote. Yeah, you were just a zygote. And zygote is not a terribly fun stage of life because you can't come to physiology class and take notes or go to physiology lab and break things, right? So you need to go from a zygote, which is a single cell, to an organism that has trillions of cells, right? So another reason for mitosis is growth. So growth is one reason for mitosis. Replace old and damaged cells is another. All right, but if you start with a single cell, like a zygote, and you end up with two cells, you want to have the same information in both cells. So a human cell has 46 chromosomes, the zygote has 46 chromosomes, and the daughter cells that develop through mitosis also have to have how many chromosomes? 46. So somewhere along the line, you have to have a duplicate copy made, and that process is what we call replication. Right, so we don't really say duplication, we say replication. So DNA replication is an important step that has to happen before mitosis takes place. All right, so when cells divide, DNA replicates itself into identical copies, and each of the two daughter cells receive one of those copies. All right, so the molecule or the enzyme that makes DNA right, is not a DNA, is not an RNA polymerase, which is what we looked at previously. It's a DNA polymerase. All right, so before the DNA polymerase binds, there is a helicase that has to break the hydrogen bonds and unwind the molecule that allows the helix to unwind, and you have two free strands of DNA. Then a DNA polymerase, which is similar to RNA polymerase, binds to each strand, right, and it makes new complementary strands based on what? Base pair rules. So each strands of DNA act as a template to make new strands of DNA. That's really important. And we call that process semi-conservative replication. So I want you to know something about that term right here, semi-conservative. It's kind of a loaded term. So let's look at this illustration. And maybe it's nicely color-coded, but maybe not. Okay, here we have, what do we have up over here? We got DNA because what, it's double-stranded. I see thymines in here. And it has unwound, the helicase has unwound it, and then DNA polymerase will then start adding nucleotides. What kind of nucleotides are these? Are these ribonucleotides or deoxyribonucleotides? Yeah. These are going to be deoxyribonucleotides because that's what DNA is made up of. All right, so both strands have to be replicated. It's not like transcription where only one strand is used. And we see then that here is one original strand of DNA. Where's the other original strand? It's up over here. Here's the other original strand of DNA. So what do you end up with after replication takes place, DNA replication? You have a double helix here and a double helix here, and each new double helix is composed of one old strand of DNA and one new strand of DNA. Here is the other double helix. Here is one old strand of DNA. Here is one new strand of DNA. All right, and so we call this semi-conservative because, and it's conservative, why? Because we never break the old strands, right? We never separate in between the nucleotide bases right here. The only thing we do is separate, we separate the strands, but we don't break a strand. If we break a strand, then we lose the primary sequence of that DNA molecule, then the cell doesn't know how to make that protein anymore. All right, so this is semi-conservative, why? Because a new strand of DNA is part old and part new, so it's semi-conservative. And the other important thing to realize is that the new strand is exactly like the old strand in the other helix over here. Why? Because an old strand of DNA is used as a template to make the new strand, right? And if that template gets destroyed, then the new strand won't be anything like what the old strand was, okay? So you end up with two identical copies of DNA due to that DNA polymerase. Okay, I've been talking a little fast because I didn't want to run out of time. So, take a deep breath, ask me a question about transcription or translation, any of that kind of stuff. You should know the name of that process where condensed chromatin is converted into extended chromatin so that it can be transcribed, for instance. That's a pretty good question. All right, should I go back to that slide? Do you have a picture of that slide in your mind? Acetylation, wonderful. So that's a control step, that's a control mechanism that controls transcription, which is a part of protein synthesis, right? So here you have condensed chromatin, it's converted to extended chromatin, which can be used by a process of acetylation. And an acetyl group is just a two-carbon fragment. You can take a glucose molecule, chop it up into three pieces, and you get to a molecule that's really close to an acetyl molecule. All right, and so when that binds, then if there are transcription factors available that control when transcription can take place on this gene right here, then that first step of protein synthesis can take place inside the nucleus. When these things are deacetylated, then the extended chromatin likes to wind back up, okay, to this condensed form. When it's in a condensed form, it can't be used for transcription, can't be used to make a protein. But what's the advantage? Why do you want to have condensed chromatin in your body? Because it's safe, because this is a really thin, fragile molecule. It can be broken, and then the primary sequence is lost, the primary sequence in DNA is lost, then the primary sequence in RNA is lost, and then the primary sequence of a protein is lost when that happens. Okay. All right, so this is safe but unusable. This is usable but a fairly fragile state for the cell to be in. Okay, what's the difference between an intron and an exon? Which part is used to make a protein? The exon is. Yeah, I had to look at that a number of times. It would have been made more sense to me if the intron was used, but it's not. It's the exon, the part that's spliced out of the pre-messenger RNA that's used to make a protein. Okay. Cytosol. Translation is cytosol. Yeah. Transcription is nucleus. Because transcription is converting information in DNA to RNA. And where do we always find DNA? It's in the nucleus, right? So you don't necessarily have to memorize that. Okay. And extended chromatin should always be in the nucleus. There's certain parts of the cell cycle where there's no nuclear envelope. But if that's the case, then that chromatin is going to be in a nice condensed form. It's going to be safe from other things that are happening inside the cell. All right, so cell cycle. This is a pretty nice review from anatomy, but we got some time to talk about it. Okay. Let's see. Oh, here's a pretty good diagram, reasonable diagram. I'm going to change it just a little bit, of the cell cycle, what a cell goes through in its entire life. All right, so it's broken down into interphase, which is the normal phase that a cell is in when it is not dividing. All right, it might be preparing for mitosis, but it's not in active mitosis. So if it's preparing for mitosis, guess what is happening? Okay, yeah, it's growing, but what's growing? The DNA is replicating itself, right? So DNA replication is an important step. The organelles have to replicate themselves so that the two daughter cells will have the exact component of organelles as well as chromosomes so that neither daughter cell gets gypped out of anything. All right, this is also the phase of a cell cycle. For instance, if this is a secretory cell, if it's secreting some kind of product, whether an endocrine or an exocrine gland, okay, or maybe a goblet cell secreting mucus, right? The interphase is the phase of the cell cycle where the cell is actually producing that particular product for secretion. Right? So it's the longest phase of within the life cycle of a cell. So we can see G1, that stands for growth phase. This is where some organelles like centrioles replicate themselves. Right, and then the middle of interphase is where DNA replication takes place, so chromosomes are replicated. And what does that mean? Chromosomes are duplicated, but we say replicated. And then here's a final growth phase. So there are a number of checks that the cell performs to make sure that it's ready to undergo mitosis before it actually undergoes mitosis. Like it counts how many chromosomes there are. Right, so if replication hasn't completed, if the number of chromosomes hasn't doubled, then it shouldn't go into mitosis because then it's going to produce mutated cells, which may not produce the same kind of function that your body needs. All right, so interphase we're going to call a growth phase, but there's also checks for make sure that the cell is ready to go undergo mitosis. Then here is the mitosis phases right over here. And you start with a parent cell, or you start with a parent cell over here, and then at the end of mitosis, you end up with two daughter cells, right? And these two daughter cells should be exactly like the parent cell in every respect, in terms of number and kinds of chromosomes and organelles and everything else, right? So you can consider these two cells like clones of each other, and the daughter cells compared to the parent cell should be clones of each other as well. They should be identical. All right, so the phases of mitosis. The first phase is when extended chromatin that we see during interphase condenses into chromosomes. And when it's condensed, the nuclear envelope can disappear, right? Because that DNA is in a nice protected form. So prophase is characterized by moving of the centrioles to opposite poles of the cell. Chromosomes that you can see underneath a light microscope because it's nice condensed chromatin. The nuclear envelope then disappears, and the formation of this spindle apparatus, which is made up of microtubules that has little motor proteins on it that can attach to a chromosome and other organelles and then starts to move these chromosomes around inside the cell. Okay, so we call that the spindle apparatus. That's the first phase. Second phase, easiest one to recognize, we call that metaphase. So at metaphase, all of the chromosomes line up right on the equator of the cell. They have attached themselves to the microtubules, and the microtubules position them right in the middle of the cell. And each one of these X's right here actually contains how many chromosomes? It contains the original chromosome and the replicated chromosome. They're attached together, so people call that one chromosome, but you should realize that there are actually two copies of a chromosome in this location right here. All right, the next phase of mitosis is when the two copies of the replicated chromosome split apart and move to opposite poles of the cell. Actually, a better way of saying that is what? Begin to migrate to opposite poles of the cell. That's anaphase. So it might be hard to recognize what's the difference between anaphase and prophase right here. I still see chromosomes. But in prophase, all the chromosomes still have just a random kind of pattern inside the cell. But during anaphase, since it comes after metaphase, you should see a nice order of these chromosomes. They line up with a nice dropout signal between them. Right? So this is a much more highly ordered arrangement of chromosomes compared to prophase. So your eye should be able to pick that out. All right. And then in telophase, the chromosomes, right, these daughter chromosomes, all right, so these are what we call daughter chromosomes. This right here, all right, we have actually two chromosomes attached to each other. We call these sister chromatids. All right, since these two chromosomes, these replicated chromosomes, are attached to each other, these are what we call sister chromatids. And then during anaphase, the sister chromatids start to separate, and we end up with these two rows of daughter chromosomes, which then are going to end up in these two daughter cells. The last phase, all right, is what we call telophase, and that's where the cell starts to pinch apart into two separate daughter cells. So the cytoplasm gets separated into two daughter cells. The organelles get separated into two special places. As they pinch apart, I see a little dimple right here and a little dimple right here. But remember, think of it in three dimensions. This is really a depression that kind of encircles this whole cell. So it's actually like a furrow. We call it a cleavage furrow. Develops during telophase. And then finally the cells separate. We call that cytokinesis. And for the purposes of this class, I think I would like for you to know that cytokinesis happens inside telophase. The separation of cytoplasm happens in the last phase of mitosis. And what's that last phase of mitosis? We call that telophase. Okay. And that's something scientists will be talking about probably for another 100 or 200 years. Where does cytokinesis take place? In some organisms and some cell lines under certain conditions, and it might actually start in anaphase, all right, and continue through telophase. And in other organisms and cells, depending on conditions, it might actually happen after the chromosomes are way on the opposite poles of the cell and the nuclear envelope starts to develop again and extended chromatin is beginning to form, all right, that may actually happen after, all right, but in this class, we can't wait 100 years to figure all that out. So on the test, we're going to say cytokinesis happens during telophase, okay? Yeah. So cytokinesis during telophase, but that might have some important ramifications in certain kinds of cells or cell lines, maybe cancer lines. For instance, maybe cytokinesis starts to happen way up over here, right? So maybe some kind of drug therapy will be able to stop or delay cytokinesis to later phases of mitosis. That might be a way to cure cancer, for instance, because cancer is just a cell line that is what? Rapidly growing, right? So that's important to just be aware of that, okay? Okay. All right, so what do these things look like? I see some chromatids right here. Here's a centromere. Now, is this a replicated chromosome or just a single chromosome? It's a single chromosome, but it is replicated. Right, so here is one old strand and one new strand. Over here is another old strand and new strand put together. So this is a replicated chromosome attached right here at the centromere. These are what we call sister chromatids. So this is exactly like this over here. So it's really two chromosomes. It contains basically, it's a redundant set of information that's contained in each of these sister chromatids. Okay, so that happens during the M phase. Okay, or S phase. And then mitosis. You got to know the order of these different phases of mitosis, starting with prophase. So what's a little word that you can make up to memorize the order? Who? Oh, PMAT. Okay, I say IPMAT, but I like PMAT. That's even a little bit better because I is not really part of mitosis. Right, so if you want to say PMAT, that's fine. It kind of rhymes with HAZMAT, which is what? HAZMAT is it's a team of people that are specially trained to deal with hazardous materials. Right, we use that. Didn't use that term long, long ago, but now that kind of resonates with IPMAT just so that you can remember the phases of mitosis. So here are some bullet points for prophase. Chromosomes become visible, distinct structures. What does that really mean? What did I say? Condensation, right? Condensation of extended chromatin to condensed chromatin by deacetylation, for instance. Metaphase, when the what else happens during prophase? Nuclear envelope disappears because it's not necessary to protect the chromosomes anymore because they're in a condensed form. Metaphase, easy, that's when all the chromosomes line up. They're positioned by spindle fibers, right, microtubules. And what controls the spindle fibers or these microtubules? Or what are the organelles inside the cell that organize the microtubules into the spindle apparatus? Yeah, those are the centrioles. And if you have a paracentriole, sometimes we call that a centrosome complex. So when a cell is ready to divide, it has two centrosomes, and each centrosome has two centrioles. Okay. Anaphase, okay, the centromere split. So the sister chromatids split into daughter chromosomes, and the spindle apparatus then pulls each new chromatid to opposite poles of the cell. And then in telophase, the cytoplasm divides. We call that cytokinesis, producing two different daughter cells. All right, so you should maybe think of mitosis as the separation of genetic material into two daughter cells. Right, but the separation of cytoplasm into two daughter cells, you should think of that as cytokinesis, right? So these are companion processes, but that's a nice way maybe you can help order what these two processes are, how they relate to each other. So cytokinesis is the separation of cytoplasm. Mitosis is the separation of genetic material into two daughter cells. All right, so here you have some nice micrographs that show extended chromatin condensing into chromosomes. That happens during prophase, and these chromosomes just have a random arrangement all over the place. Centrioles are beginning to migrate to opposite poles of the cell, and the spindle apparatus is developing. And then we see a nice metaphase right here, nicely developed spindle apparatus. Chromosomes are lined up right on the equator of the cell. The sister chromatids then start to separate. They're pulled apart from each other on the spindle apparatus during anaphase. And then telophase, you have the development of the cleavage furrow and development of the plasma membrane between these two daughter cells. And eventually, the nuclear membrane will reform to protect these chromosomes. And when the nuclear membrane is back, what can happen to this condensed chromatin? It can be extended, so that transcription can take place and the cell can start producing new proteins as a result. Okay, I guess I got a couple other organelles. Here's a nice picture of some centrosomes, of a centrosome, a couple of centrioles. And what's their job? Probably you should know the function of a centriole or a centrosome. What does it control? It controls where microtubules go inside the cell and how the microtubules function, right? So organelles can attach themselves to that monorail system inside the cell, the arrangement of microtubules inside the cell, and catch a ride from one side of the cell to another, right? So it's a way of positioning vesicles or chromosomes or mitochondria around inside the cell. And microtubules also attach to proteins that are embedded in the plasma membrane. We call those integrin proteins. And microtubules can push and pull on those proteins and can change the shape of the plasma membrane. So it can determine the shape of the cell, whether a cell is going to undergo phagocytosis or not, and that's all ATP dependent. So the centrosomes control and organize the microtubule and microfilament system inside the cell for a number of different processes. Okay. Telomeres. Oh, here's something that's pretty interesting. Telomeres, that just, what phase is telophase of mitosis? That's the final phase. So telo means the end of something or the tip of something, okay? And a telomere or telomere is the end of nucleic acid, like DNA, which is a bunch of nucleotides all together. And every time a cell undergoes mitosis, DNA polymerase can't reproduce the very tip of a chromosome because it like runs off the end. It's like a train running off the end of a train track. All right, so every time a cell undergoes mitosis, it can't reproduce the very tip of a chromosome. So the chromosome gets shorter and shorter and shorter every time the cell undergoes mitosis. And then there gets to be a certain point where so much of the end of the chromosome is lost that it cannot be replicated. And when that happens, then that signals for that cell to die. We call that apoptosis. So that's a nice normal process. So not all the cells in your body should live your whole life. They shouldn't be reproducing. So it's a way of controlling mitosis. All right? And we call that senescence. When a cell line is so old because it's gone through so many different steps of, or so many times, so many mitosis events, all right, then it dies as a result of that. So it's like a molecular clock. There is an enzyme that can rebuild that sequence that's lost by mitosis, and it's called telomerase. So telomerase can extend the life of a cell line by replacing the telomere. So instead of being lost every time that cell goes through mitosis, it's rebuilt. So essentially, that cell can live how long? It can live forever. All right, so that might sound really good, except apoptosis is a very important kind of mechanism to make sure that a cell doesn't live forever. And there are certain cells in your body, okay, that can live forever and become a problem, like cancer cells. Cancer cells don't die, right? They just undergo mitosis, and after they undergo mitosis, what do they do again? Undergo mitosis, and they just grow and grow and grow without any of those cells ever dying. That produces huge tumors, which then can lead to, of course, the death of a person. All right, so telomerase is that enzyme that allows tumor cell lines to live forever. So it would be cool for somebody to come up with some other kind of treatment that can what? Inhibit telomerase, because then what will happen to those cancer cells? They eventually will die. And then what happens to the tumor? It goes away. Okay, so this is a particularly fruitful place for current research for ways at a molecular level to deal with all kinds of different cell lines that are cancerous as a result of that. So I don't know if that says it, all of that in this slide right here, but next one, nice. Telomerase. All right, so remember, telomerase is an enzyme that can extend the life of a cell line indefinitely, and that's one of the problems with cancer cell lines, is that they have that ability to live forever. So if we can inhibit this telomerase, then that's potentially a really good treatment for cancer. I lost my cursor completely. I don't know what happened. Ah, here it came back. Nice. Okay. All right, so that's it. That's it for the test. So meiosis is not going to be on the test. All right, and we're going to talk about meiosis when we get into the reproductive chapter. I'll just say one little thing about meiosis. Okay, mitosis is the process of making, okay, two daughter cells that are exact copies of the parent cell. Meiosis, on the other hand, is a process, it came back out. Let's go to the very last slide. Meiosis is the process of starting with a parent cell, but instead of one round of division, there are two rounds of division, and you get four cells instead of two. And these cells are different from each other, and they contain half the number of chromosomes compared to the parent cell. So these right here are sex cells. They're different than the parent cell. which partially explains when you look around the room, do you see another you? Okay, this is the basis of sexual reproduction, which is how you came into being, which explains why you're sort of like your parents, but different than your parents, but sort of like other people in the room, but different than other people in the room, because this is what? Sexual reproduction. Mitosis, on the other hand, is asexual reproduction. It just produces the same thing over and over and over again. So you might want to think about, why is it important to produce new things via meiosis right here? Instead of producing the same thing over and over again, why is it important to produce new things or different things, new and different things? Okay, which is sexual reproduction. Okay, so next time we have a test, so you need your non-graphene scientific calculator. You need a Scantron. I didn't bring an example of a Scantron for me. It's in the syllabus which one it is, which is what, a 4884, is it, or 882? 882, it's just like this one, and it should be with letters inside the bubbles, and the bubbles shouldn't be shaded. They should be just nice white. That's the easiest for the Scantron reader. A pencil, a really good eraser. Check to make sure your eraser works with your pencil, because sooner or later in the class, if you make a smudge on your Scantron and the Scantron reader can't read it, I won't give you credit for that answer either, right? So that's just to help you prepare for board exams that are coming up, because they never let you check your Scantrons and give you partial credit or whatever. You also need, what else? Photo ID. You need a photo ID, and you get the whole period until 10 to 12, no, 10 to 1, all right? So. Oh, I bet I didn't pass the sign-in sheet around. Okay, not a good time to ask for a sign-in sheet. Ask me at the beginning of class, please, because I would like to know who's here. There's some students that are skipping. That would be really bad. Yeah, so just ask me at the beginning, because I forgot I had it right here. So no sign-in sheet to answer your question. No sign-in sheet today. Okay? Don't forget your photo ID for next time and your calculator, and you can't share your ID with somebody. And you can't share your calculator with anybody or your eraser. Okay? Yeah. 11:30 till 10 to 1. Yeah.